How good does it get, SK?
Why not us, Troy?
Today, live from the Pinecrest Inn, it's the Smiley Show. So long, everybody.
This is the Smiley Show.
What's up, everybody? Happy to be joined in by Mr. Cashmere Keith, or as Steve Sams would say, television's Keith Mitchell. Keith, you're going to be in New Orleans this week playing in the PGA Tour event. Did you know that you almost saw me there playing in the dang golf tournament? Have you heard about this?
I saw, I think it was a tweet or something, and I pretended to block it and pretend that it wasn't there, because all I was thinking, if you had alternate shot teeing off on 18 coming down to try to make the stretch, what was going to go through your mind?
I mean, come on. It's been since 2022 since I've played a professional golf tournament, Keith. I just think that Ryan sending me that text, Ryan Gerard, if you haven't seen the story, Ryan sent me a text Sunday night about playing the Zurich Classic. It was an unofficial, official-ish invite, as he tried to source other players. Where, thank goodness, he found a good player in Yellow Miraju. But I tell you what, Keith.
Great player right now, by the way.
I know. Like, it was a great ad. I mean, going from him to me? I mean, yes. Come on, Keith. Like, I could have found it, but I literally told Ryan, I was like, I would have to have a cocktail, like, on the first tee. Like, no doubt. Right? Like
this, nothing against you, Smiley, but Yellow Miraju is killing it right now.
Yeah, he is. He's really good at golf.
And he might have one of the few names better than yours.
I know. That's a good point. He did an interview recently, like, I think with Roger Seal on the PGA Tour. I guess he doesn't date anybody, but he listed Sydney Sweeney as somebody he was interested in. I was like, this guy, he's got pizzazz, man. He's guy's got it. Well, for those of you that don't know, Keith and I are the exact same age. We grew up playing junior golf together. My earliest memories, Keith, I would say probably would be up playing in the USJGT tour up in Tennessee. You and I were playing that tour, and I vividly remember going to, I think it was Charlie Killen's house up there, like near the honors, and us three were just kind of gooning around at probably 10, 11 years old. I mean, we go back 20 plus years, man.
At least. Yeah. It was the three of us on the range trying to hit the cart, just like any other kid wants to do, the range picker. But yeah, I mean, God, we had to have been at least no more than 12, right? Probably 10, 11, 12. No,
it's, I mean, all right. So tell me about the honors. Like, did you grow up playing out at the honors at all? Was this a place? I know you went to Belmont in high school. How often did you get up to the honors?
Baylor.
What did they call it? Belmont?
Belmont. That's a college.
Well, it's still in Tennessee, though. Yeah.
I mean, look, it's, well, anyway. yeah, the honors is very, very close to my heart. I was very fortunate that my dad joined the club long before I was ever born. So I basically grew up going out there. And for those who have been, you know how special it is. And for those who haven't, it's a bucket list kind of place. And, you know, the honors is, when people ask me my top, like, favorite golf course, or, you know, what's your favorite place to play, which, by the way, is one of the most commonly asked questions a PGA Tour player gets.
It's crazy, right? It's oftentimes at these Q&As, man. Like, it's the first question people put their hands up.
What's your favorite course?
You're just like, you're just kind of searching for something other than Augusta National. You're like,
Well, Cypress, so I've broken kind of run it. I've broken it. Yeah, I've broke. So I've had to ask that. I've been asked that question so much, I've broken down into like a three-part question, where it's like, just tee to green, right? Like, you show up on the first tee and you leave after 18. Nothing else is included. Fisher's Island's up there. The layout is incredible. The experience from start to finish, from like when you pull up to the gate, you spend the night and you leave the next day, the food, the locker room, the staff, all that. I put a hoopie up there.
Dude, right there with you, man. That is such it's a good answer. Good answer.
Yeah. And then sentimental value. Or if I had one course to play the day before I died, right? Like, if it's your last course, your dying round, is 100% the honors, because that's where just like all my emotion and sentimental value and nostalgia comes from, is that place. And like, and, you know, like we said, Charlie Killian, his dad was a head pro there forever. And so we kind of, you and I were all the same age. Charlie and I went to like preschool together, elementary school together. So we had a little bit of unfair treatment. We would just like get our own spot at the back of the range, and our dads would go play golf. And it was just the two of us for 6 hours, just like messing around. So very lucky to grow up there.
Charlie's a big visor guy too, isn't he?
He's not afraid to pull one off. That's for sure.
Yeah. What am I doing here? I'm wearing my visor thinking I'm coming on to interview Keith Mitchell. He's not even wearing cashmere. I mean, I'm trying to, you know, spice it up a little bit here for the show. And here we are, you know, just a casual Monday here for Keith at home.
Hey, yeah, you're thank you for playing my part.
All right. So Keith, you know, on my bucket list of golf courses in my top three is currently Honors. For whatever reason, I'm 2 hours away. The only time I've been to the Honors was with you and Charlie on the back of the range when we were 10 years old. I haven't played this golf course yet, man. We got to make it happen.
Well, I did not know that. Thinking you were out there, but we'll get it done.
Hasn't happened. I know you're busy, man. I know you're busy.
Well, it's one of the few golf places I'll travel for golf. Right, like we travel for a work for golf. It's one of the few, like, I have a week off, but then I'm going to travel some more for golf. That's one of the places I'll do it. You know, we got to get Henrik to get us an open slot in the cabins. I mean, those things are booked out 6-7 months in advance, so we might have to call in a favor, but we'll get it done.
All right, where would you travel right now if you could go anywhere to play, a place that you haven't played that's on the top of your bucket list? I know that's probably another question that's been asked of you.
I want to do the, I can't remember. I think I might have answered this recently, but I want to do the Long Island Day where you play Shinnecock in the morning, big lunch at National, and play National in the afternoon. So I've put the bug in a friend of ours head that I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it with him, and we're going to make it happen. I've never played either one of those places. I've heard they're amazing.
Really?
US opens at Shinnecock this year, so the National Shinnecock duo is definitely something I want to do that I've never done before.
I've played National, been lucky enough to get out there a couple times, but I've driven past Shinny multiple times, and I'm like, man, this place looks unbelievable. And every person I've talked to, whether it be Dan Hicks and guys who've worked US Opens before, says this is probably their favorite US Open venue. So I am absolutely stoked to get up there for the Shinnecock US Open. But that sounds like one heck of a day. A little lobster for a little lunch. Head out for the boys with a little, what's their drink up there? It's not a Manhattan. What is the drink? God, Charlie, you might have to come in here if you can't help us out.
Southside. National does one that's very different than Shinnecock. So you got to try both and compare.
Oh, okay. I'm good. Because I wasn't going to keep it to one Southside either way. So I'm glad I have a reason to have more than one now.
That's right. We did 36 at National last summer, and in between did the lobster lunch with the Southside. And we finished that 36 hole. I'm like, this is it. You can just take my clubs, just throw them in the Peconic, whatever the bay is there, because that's as good as it's going to get in the game of golf.
Don't let him tease you here, Keith. He played at 7 a.m. the next morning at Deepdale. Come on.
Which also has a great south side, by the way. Deepdale south side's another.
And speaking of like epic lunches with golf, I've heard the Muirfield Day is equally as epic.
Have you played there? No.
And so I've been over to North Berwick and done that whole deal, you know, with the Scottish, and it's just unbelievable. And then I played the Open at St. Andrews right after, but I didn't get to play Muirfield. And I have a buddy that's a member of there, and he was like, we'll go play like Monday afterwards or something. It's like sandwich day. I can't remember exactly, but it's just, you know, they just make a bunch of pre-made sandwiches. I'm like, I'm going when we can do the lunch and then do the alternate shot. And it's, I don't know, someone's going to have to pipe in here, but they have that over there.
Oh, I don't know the drink, but I know it's like a mashed potato Thanksgiving meal that I know they have in between rounds. But do you know what they do in that second 18, Keith?
It's alternate shot, right?
That's right. It's like you don't even walk to the back tee. In the afternoon, you just walk to the fairway,
which is great because if I've had that much food and drink, the last thing I want to do is play 18 old. I'll play 9.
yeah, exactly. It's cool, man.
Charlie, figure out what that drink is.
It's the Kummel, I think is how it's pronounced. And you know what? There's another course in the general region, Pamir, that has a really good one. It's kind of like it's a colorless, a sweet colorless liqueur flavored with caraway seed, cumin, and fennel. Known as the golfer's liqueur. So there you go.
Sounds terrible, man.
There was a lot of pronunciation in there that I really hope I got right.
I don't know. That we're gonna have to get a pronunciation guide, but long story short, I've heard it's keeps Muirfield quenches their thirst, let's put it that way.
I could just see you out there in the afternoon in Muirfield just with a nice Cabernet, you know, just walking around, you know, just with a little bottle of wine that you pull out of the bag, pour in a little small glass. I mean, a little red wine after a nice Thanksgiving meal in Muirfield kind of sounds nice.
Red wine on a golf course is something I've not partaken in, but maybe we start that.
It sounds like a terrible idea, but you can get away with it in Muirfield because it wouldn't be quite as hot, right?
We're not even going to be invited just because of this conversation we're having.
Oh my gosh. Oh man. All right. Well, while you're here, Charlie, I think Keith is one of the more intelligent guys when it comes to just whether it be technique. I think when you've been on the tour now for, gosh, is this your ninth year, Keith?
Yeah, ninth on tour, two on Corn Ferry, and one on Latino America. So 12 seasons.
You've been a pro for quite some time, which means you picked up a ton of information, whether it be from different coaches, a lot of players. I'm sure you have a wealth of knowledge now. And I think from watching your short game since your early days as a pro till now, I think it looks drastically different from when you started to where you are now. And we had, help us with his last name. We know it's the short game chef, Parker McLaughlin.
McLaughlin, yeah.
All right. It doesn't sound that way when you look at it, McLaughlin. It looks like McLaughlin. So just want to make sure we get his last name right. But I know he's helped you out a bunch with your short game. He sent us over some clips. So the first thing I want to ask you about with pitching and chipping is your release pattern and how you take the club back. To me, it doesn't look like a ton of wrist set on the way back, a lot of just straight arms. Was this something that you always naturally done, or is this something you've had to work really hard on to then get that release pattern where you have a ton of rotation through?
So one of the things Parker helped me with most was trying to mimic what I did well in my golf swing and implement in my short game. So if you watch me hitting a driver or a 7-iron, whatever, I have very little wrist set in the beginning of my golf swing. Mm. Honestly, sometimes my hands like drag the club back.
It's like Duffer, man.
Very similar. And except his waggle is all wrists and his takeaway yeah. is all that. It's pretty funny. But I have a very late wrist set, as some people would call it. And I was trying to get like maximum spin on my wedges and my chips and pitches. And so I would have some hinge and I would have a lot of shaft lean and they would come out hot and low, perfectly fine, but I didn't have the high shot very well. Mm-hmm. And so Parker was like, let's take some of this hinge out a little bit, and it eliminates ball speed, right? So like hinging is a ball speed mechanism. It's like lag, right? When you have a lot of lag coming down, that's ball speed. Well, it's basically what, when you hinge the club on the way back, you're building that lag in. So long story short, we took some of that out, and then right here, I don't know how live this is, but that's something I'm trying to use hinge. I'm trying to get some speed because I'm trying to hit the ball up with a lot of spin,
right?
So to break down basically 3 years worth of work with Parker into a couple sentences, you know, we build a baseline, and then you read the lie, and then you read the shot, and then you try to work off that. And so, and the baseline was my golf swing. And I truly believe that guys that can mimic the pattern of their golf swing into their chipping, what they do well in their golf swing into their chipping and do it properly, that's the recipe for success. Joel Damon, one of the best ball strikers I have ever seen, has a lot of hinge and a lot of download. So when he tries to chip like I do right there, disaster, right? Because it's completely different than his golf swing. But like if you slowed my golf swing down, that looks very similar, you know, if I'm hitting a wedge. Very little wrist cock, a lot of rotation, and, you know, a pretty shallow attack.
Yeah.
So not to pick on Joel here, but he went to work with Parker for a little bit after seeing some of Mike's success, and he basically got the chipping yips from around the green. because it just didn't meet his pattern. He went to see Joe Mayo, who likes a lot of shuffling and downward attack and angle of attack, and he started chipping incredible. So it truly, to me, there's no one way to chip. I would tell everybody the way to chip is the closest way to your golf swing.
Man, that's interesting. I've never really heard it spoken like that, but I can often say that when I'm swinging the golf club well, and oftentimes when I make corrections in my swing, whether it be, I need to get my hips more this way, or I need to work on my takeaway in my golf swing, oftentimes that's translated to my pitching of like, oh, wait, I didn't realize that this was affecting my pitching too, the things I was doing in my golf swing. So it's really interesting when you say that.
Well, it's very true, because like if you go work on your short game for, 3 hours a day for four straight days and you don't hit many golf balls, it's impossible to tell me that it's not going to bleed in, right? Because it's still a golf club. You're still, you're holding it the same way, basically give or take, and you're hitting shots. Something will come up from that. I had that same problem, is because I started having so much success with Parker. I started chipping and chipping and chipping. And then all of a sudden, my takeaway was getting very similar to my pitching motion, and I had to work around it. So again, if you're going to work on your short game, make sure that it's cohesive with your golf swing. And then if it is a little different, that's fine. But you've got to have to balance your practice, because, if you start getting left and standing up on it, constantly, all of a sudden you do that for a month, that's going to bleed in your golf game. Or, if you try to get real shallow and real wide and you do that for a month, it's going to do the same thing's going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's one way or the other.
Interesting.
It's going to bleed. You got to be careful.
What tour player, Keith, would you say you would go up to who's got a wealth of knowledge and maybe matches your pattern the best, that you feel like you can go and say, hey, how do you hit this shot? Like, what player are you going to go up to on the short game area?
You said it already. It's Duff. I think Duff is the most underrated short game in the history of the PGA Tour. I have so many stories about him, helping me, hitting shots. I'll never forget, I was at the Dominican Republic last year, and he was playing one of his last few events, and I was down in this little bowl hitting shots, and he walked by. I'm like, come on, Duff, just please just hit me one. I learn better by watching you chip than you telling me what to do. So he just grabs my wedge, rakes the ball, doesn't even basically look at the hole, just flicks it up there, one hop, bounces right in the hole, and just hands me my club and walks off. And I've been down in this spot trying to master this shot, and one swing, my wedge, boom, makes it. Absolutely the best short game I've ever seen on anything from like a 7-iron bump to a pitching wedge back foot to a high soft flop shot to bunker game. He's incredible. And I even have a video saved on my phone of him chipping at the John Deere that I like go back to and like, all right, like watch this and try to implement it into my brain. I mean, of course, Phil and Patrick Reed have amazing short games, but theirs are because they
do it a different way.
Yeah, crazy shots, right?
Yeah,
Phil does it different. Patrick does it different. Duff does it different. Those guys, I mean,
he throws the head so much, man. Like what he does as far as just the trust he has to be able to throw the right arm and right hand and the club face at it. Like you look at his club face after impact, it's just like around his left shoulder already.
Crazy. Yeah. And so I put Phil and P Reed up there, and I put Duff, which is not as sexy, I would call it, as those two, but efficiency wise, he is insane.
Yeah. So what about this? All right. So I'm going to put Jordan and Scotty in a different little category, because these are now, I think, more of the drivers. Like Phil Mickelson drives it. Jordan and Scotty, when you watch them, man, it's the way they move the club head. It's more up and out, and they're coming down straight on top of it for that low spinner. But my question is for those guys who or maybe a little steeper backswing, how are they able to hit the high one? Because that's the thing, that if you've ever gone there and tried to do what they do for these low spinners, well, do you just change the shaft setup? Like, how do you get it up in the air and not be worried about catching it fat? Like, if you're somebody that is on that side of the spectrum there.
I've always looked at it as like margin for error in the shot, and then margin for error in your pattern. So to explain that, let's just say Scotty and Jordan, for example, they hit down on it, right? It might not be the best shot to play with a tight pin. Right. But they know that they're going to hit their spot with maybe a little lower flight on a more consistent basis than trying to do something different to gain the margin for error in the shot. So you have to weigh margin for error in your pattern or in your swing to hit the right ball flight, and then margin for error and how good you are at landing it on your spot.
Right.
So I would say that those guys are so good at picking their spot, even if it's not as efficient as, you know, throwing it straight up with more spin so they have more, you know, margin for error when it lands on the green. They actually have a smaller place to land it to get it close because of their ball flight. But they're so good, and they're so good at short game that that's they're going to pull that shot off just as well as someone that's going to, like, P-read and flick it and throw it straight up. So, I think there's optimizing – you know, ball flight, spin, trajectory on TrackMan, then optimizing contact and how good you are at landing it there. Yeah, I think those are two completely separate things. And the more a player can understand and be honest with themselves about those two, the better their short game is going to get.
Yeah, good advice. Landing spot, always important. You mentioned Duff. One question, what was the shot that you were trying to pick up from Duff, and what does Duff do so well that you were kind of trying to chase that feel? Is it something that he does with his hands or the way he sets his wrists on the way back to be able to throw the club head a little better? What's your memories of that shot?
He, which I think a lot of teachers teach this. I don't think this is like one side of the Cold War or the other, but it's, you know, make sure you're kind of moving up through the ball. And not moving down. I would think not moving down is probably the better word. Yeah. But, you know, really guys that are really good, they actually kind of go up. And what happens when you go up, the club can release and it kicks out to get, you know, you're actually reaching to get to the ball. So the shaft lean comes out and the head starts to pass. And so you add a lot of loft to the shot that gets the ball up. What happens is when you go down and your knees go toward the ball, your grip goes toward the ball, you lose this space, and then you that's when you see that, right?
And you see the chest and sternum go back this way, man. And boy, I got some buddies that got that going on.
And it sounds crazy to tell somebody to move up and away from the ball because they think they're going to skull it. Well, it's because the club has to kick out and it has to release and the gravity has to throw that head down to reach the ball, which gives all that loft to the club and then it sends it up. So that's the number one thing with Duff. And then just his rhythm, man. Like, his rhythm is so nice. I mean, his golf swing rhythm's nice too. So, I mean, it carries over. But most importantly, I think that goes blanket statement for chipping. You got to stay level or move up. If you go down, you're dead.
Well, there you go, folks. Write it down in your notes, whatever you need. Cashmere just broke it down, the short game. Last thing I want to get into here, just in your what you've been able to pick up out on the golf course and on the range is, you know, being on out on tour for 9 years, a lot has changed, right? Like, technology's changed, more coaches. You get to observe a lot. What's the one takeaway for you that I think that people may not realize happens quite as much, whether it be how guys are training on at the range or how they're training at the putting green? Like, what are things that guys are doing every single day that you've kind of picked up on that you've been able to incorporate in your own game?
Going to the gym. That is like, even in my time, like, it was definitely there. Like, people were going to the trailers and working out and stuff. But I mean, you go in on a morning wave tee time at 7:30. I mean, there's 15 guys in the gym, and that's, and then the people are rotating in and out, in and out. It's wild how many guys are in the gym every single day. That's number one. Number two is TrackMan. A lot of guys, I don't even care if you use it for your swing or not. That's not what this is about. It's about using it for your spin and your yardages and your calibration at the golf course. Because if you go to a place and it's 1,000 feet above sea level, or it's at sea level, or the temperature or the wind, you know, or you're hitting, you're testing a new club or a new ball, like, you cannot live without these things. And I say that is, like, back in the old days, you know, guys would probably just see a ball and be like, oh, that's what I'm looking for. We still say that's what I'm looking for, but, like, if you don't have the numbers behind it, like, it might as well just not even matter. So, like, the data that in you know, there's obviously quads or foresights or whatever all of them are, but the data that we use on a day-to-day basis to calibrate our either swing or, you know, our distances and trajectories and, you know, spin rates is we do it every day, period, hands down.
Yeah. And it's funny, when I go back to the web.com days, Keith, when you and I were on that tour, I vividly remember, like, only one person having, like, a TrackMan out there with them. And this was, gosh, I think this was in Colombia. Peter Uline was the only guy on the bus with, like, a TrackMan. I was like, God, this guy must be rich, you know? It's just like, it's like, and it's like, and gosh, he's probably a little too technical for my liking, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that honestly, that was the stigma around TrackMans. Is, oh, you're too technical, you know, you golf's more feel. I agree. I'm agreeing on the teaching side of things, but on the calibration side and equipment side, you're just behind the eight ball if that's the case.
In my rookie year, I got a quad, and I was the only really guy out on the tour with it. But my short game coach, James Siekman, said, hey, you need to get this. It's, like, super simple. You just turn it on. You put the golf ball in the little box, and you hit it. It tells you how far you hit it. It's great for hitting your numbers. I'm like, okay, that seems pretty great. And every tour player would come up to me and ask, like, what is that thing? I'm like, dude, it's kind of like, it's dummy proof. Like, it's redneck proof. Like, you just turn it on, you hit it, and it tells you how far it goes. And they're like, is it good? I was like, yeah, it seems like it's pretty good. My wedge game's pretty sharp. Little did I know, I needed to get some royalties in this thing and get some equity in the business at the time, because I was a first time user in this thing.
Well, it's crazy now that, like, I didn't really use it for my numbers until 2024, and my strokes gained approach went through the roof because of exactly what you said and what you did. And it doesn't matter what machine. I mean, sure, it would have been nice for, you know, for you to do that, but you were ahead of the curve. I don't know what year that would have been. It was before I was on tour. But,
this was 16, man. Like, I was
way, it's like, back. You think of the old days, like, guys would drop towels on the range, and their caddies would, and they have a range finder, and they'd shoot the bag from a towel, and you'd lay them out so that you would try to land it on the towel, but you never really knew how close you were, especially over, like, 60 to 70 yards, unless your caddy was, like, standing out there. Now you just put it down behind us on your phone. Boom.
I know. It's so simple now. It's so much easier to be able to work on your game, especially trying to simulate golf on the range. Used to be so difficult. It used to be so boring. It took, like, a big imagination and a lot of games of creativity to really test yourself to stay in that competition mode. Now guys just get on, whether it be foresight or TrackMan, and just run these combines, man. And, like, it's the best way to train your brain on the range. Yep.
100%.
All right, Charlie, why don't you get in here? Speaking of wedge shanks, Charlie's got a bit of a wedge shank problem.
what a great way to bring me in. Thanks a ton, Charlie. Really appreciate that.
Well, we got a bunch to get into with Charlie here, but we might as well start with, I mean, your brand is obviously changed a ton, right, Keith? Like, from your rookie year until now, like, I think when I think of Keith Mitchell, I start with cashmere. And I think we got to get the backstory of, I believe it was Jim Nantz that kind of coined you that cashmere, but, you know, when did this all kind of change for you in your mind with your brand?
I've always been a visor guy. You know, Nike didn't make a visor that was up to my standards, I would call it. But they, you know, their hat was fine. So when I had some great partners come through, Cisco as front of my visor, you know, an incredible company, a great team over there. I love working with them. I've been with them since 2019.
Wow.
So before I was wearing their visor, they were on my bag. And they came through and created a great opportunity for me Because I mean, look, Nike's business model is great. They want a clean slate, right? Now, when you want a clean slate, you got to pay for all the other logos and the opportunity cost for a player and all the other logos. Long story short, Cisco came through, and I had the ability to wear whatever I wanted to wear. And so I just started picking out my clothes and doing and like who you know cashmere sweater is great. Like why would you not want to wear that? Tiger wore a cashmere sweater that had with Nike on it. Like I never got those. But Tiger was wearing cashmere with Nike. I
Was
couldn't
it
figure out
in the shipment?
where are these? Where are these made? Like what's going on? I would just hammer them. They're like, oh yeah, kind of like hush hush. But so anyway, I started wearing it. I was playing good at Pebble, and Colt's original caddy, John Davenport, was calling me that, and then he passed it to Colt. Colt called me that on air at Pebble. Jim liked it. And then when Jim Nantz calls you a nickname, it's coined, which is pretty funny because my nickname before that was Kevin, because Hicks called me Kevin,
That's
Nantz did
right.
call me Kevin, Johnny Miller called me Kevin, like
Kevin
everybody
Mitchell.
called me Kevin Mitchell. And then Nantz flipped it the script and took the Kevin away and got Cashmere, which, you
Doesn't
know,
Harris or HUD still call you Kevin?
everybody does. Like I'm still Kev in JT Poston's phone, I think. I mean, like it's Kevin is, you know, Sepp calls me Kevin. Ricky calls me Kevin. A lot of people still call me Kevin. And now it's, at one point, I thought it was that people that didn't know my name call me Kevin. Now it's like people that are like really know me call me Kev. It's pretty funny.
Keith, I want to kind of reel this back a little bit to the mood board to create this look you have here. And let me start by saying, let me be the third person on this podcast to shout out Charlie Killian, because he's currently in the process of outfitting the Hope Valley Men's League team with some nice cotton shirts, not dissimilar to what you wear on the golf course right now. So shout out Charlie Killian. But also, I was down in Atlanta a few years back with a buddy, Jonathan Baker, who was working at Sid Mashburn for the first
JB.
time. JV, love JV. And he it was just so interesting to hear him talk about, really, before I kind of knew your backstory and how you kind of moved from a guy that was wearing the Nike script that we saw here on the screen to this visor look. And he said, yeah, basically, Keith came in here and said, I want to look like Arnold Palmer in the 1970s. And so take us back to how you put this sort of mood board together in your mind. You show up at Sid Mashburn and you say, this is what I want to look like, what that process looked like for them.
Well, let's be clear. Nike was a farther stretch from me and my DNA than what's current the current situation. So like don't see me as Nike and then moving to this.
Fair.
See me as here, and then Nike was just like blip in the screen.
You
It's like
pulled it
if,
off, though. I mean, you pulled off the athletic Nike deal.
well, I appreciate it. But you know, I wore like Georgia, we would wear visors, and you know, and I remember Harris gave me such a hard time when like we didn't have to wear. Sorry, Charlie, I went off to I went this little tangent here,
It's
but it's
good. We
background.
love tangents around here.
I was, you know, in Georgia, you could wear whatever you want on the range. Like if you showed up from workouts, you could hit balls. And Harris would always come to me, he's like, dude, it looks like you're going to play Augusta National when you're showing up to practice. Because like I would just kind of like dress up, like dress to play golf. And so anyway, that's kind of my baseline. And I had always shopped at Sid, and they're a great company. And you know, I had a lot of dress shirts. Like this is a Sid terry cloth polo right here. But
Oh, I've heard all about the terry cloth, even a terry cloth visor.
oh
I've
yeah.
seen that in action Phoenix this year.
And so JB was there. He was a big part of this because the Mashburns golf is not on their radar, like literally at all. They're a tennis and fashion group, and I'm the, you know, JB was my golf connection. If it wasn't for JB having a big, you know, golf IQ, I would have been, I don't think any of this would have ever happened, because they're like, what is golf kind of thing. So we go there, and I put on all their, we get a bunch of dress pants and shirts, and I'm like in the office like doing squats and doing all this stuff to try to see if like the stuff works, and it ended up working. And you know, I've been wearing it ever since.
And
And
has there been a sorry, Charlie, has there been a day though where you got like the perfect outfit on, and then maybe you quite didn't realize how hot it was going to be that day, or the humidity was going to be a little on the high side, or maybe, hey, like this wool pant or whatever the pant might be, or a wool shirt, all of a sudden got a little steamy. Has that happened a couple times, I imagine?
No. Because you
even if it was, you're like, it's totally like, fine. Like you could be beating sweat. You're like, still
it's
good.
Preparing for it's preparing just like you're preparing your equipment, right? Like you just look at the weather. Like,
just seeing if there was a wrong forecast and over the years.
And I mean, Pebble's the only one that'll get you, but like, you know, you'll have two sweaters on. Or Scotland, right? Like it's sunny, and then it usually goes the other way. It's rare that it's like, oh, it's hotter than the forecast. Like it's like, oh, it's going to be 68, and then all of a sudden a storm front rolls in, and it's blowing 30, and it's raining, so that 68 feels like 48. So it's usually the other way.
All right, and this is a perfect tee up here, because I was telling Smiley about this before we hopped on. He was equally skeptical. You mentioned that you shopped at Sid Mashmer before they outfitted you, right? And I was telling Smiley, listen, I went in there with JB when he was telling me this story, and we were kind of had the run of the place looking around, and I don't want to get one thing in there, and I landed on a pair of cashmere sweatpants, maybe my favorite luxury lounge item that I own in my entire closet. So what I want to know is, What is the Keith Mitchell owned piece from Sid Mashburn that we don't see on the golf course that's like your prized possession from that store?
I have I don't know. I don't even know what the material is. It's like, it's not like velvet. It was like velour or some sort of like terry something. Long sleeve, like ivory polo. It is so sick. I was so afraid that they were going to sell out of them. I just bought them. Like I didn't even call. I didn't even ask. I was like, I got to make sure I get a couple of these before they're gone, and they're gone. I don't know. I don't know if you can find them. I wore
it. It's like rubbing a polar bear, I imagine.
Yes. It's unbelievable. I wore it. I did a Gary Williams five gloves, like right before the Optum games. I wore it in that little piece with him. And then I wore it just one day when Bo Hostler just like randomly took a video of me like getting one of his getting a coffee at San Antonio. And just like people like, what is that? What is that? I'm like, it's gone. Sorry. I bought them all. I'm all literally. Sorry,
I have 42 of them if you need one.
And so that's one. And then the other is the Canepa Canvas five pockets. Like I'm not a five pockets guy. Like it's just on a golf course. So non-golf course, these are like, it's almost like a hip linen, like super natural flowy, like summer jean. They're called Canepa Canvas. Same thing. I'll just like every color, every year, just send them to me.
I'm going to work back up to the top of the head here, back to the visor. And first off, I think you need to convince people why they should be visor guys. Like I wore a visor in college, wore it on tour a bit, kind of been a hat guy, but I'm actually making a rebound back to the visor just to let you know. So happy to join you in Team Vise. But I also want to tell people that it's easy to let people know what your mood is, because with a visor, you know, you could be in the zone right here down. But if it's not the day you got going on, I've seen Keith Mitchell out on the PGA Tour many, many of time with this old look. And this is when you know how the day's going, right? Like, is this not like, don't talk to me. This is stay away.
I just made bogey. I just three-putted. Yeah, that's exactly right. You're just exactly like, right. Yeah, yes. I mean, it's got to be just a little.
And a little crooked, too. Yeah, it's just like. There you go. It's like, what are we doing out here today, Brad? Disheveled, like, what are we doing?
Yeah, disheveled Keith. You're looking at it right there.
So you got that. But then it's also like, man, I just made a couple birdies in a row, like kind of like midweek, but it's straight, having a good time. So there's a lot of different ways to wear the visor and also let people know how you're playing.
Yes. Yeah. And now that that's out there, if you see me walking like that, you know, you just made bogey. I'm going to be real happy then.
Exactly. I see that, Charlie.
Can we talk putters now, Smiley? We waited so long. Yes. I mean, I'm a sick putter tinkerer, Keith. And so we had Ryan Gerard on the show here a couple months ago, and he's talking about, I think it made its way on a Golf WRX, the actual cashmere putter you got made, that one of one, maybe like a Japan style. What do you think, if you had to estimate your total count of putters in the collection and like maybe a handful of also your favorites, your most unique pieces, what number would that be in total?
I mean, I probably have four that are just like, they're not golf putters. Like they're like really fun putters. And then every other putter that I have was a specific reasoning to try to put in play for like a performance wise. So I'd say four fun putters, like the one that you're talking about, the Napa style. Like I'm never going to use that in a tournament, but man, is it the coolest thing ever. and then I got like a GSS, like mallet that doesn't have any sight lines or anything, just super clean that, you know, I'm not going to use that. But every other putter I have, TaylorMade, Odyssey, Scotty, Ping, doesn't matter. There's a reason that I got that putter to try to put in play. And, you know, if it worked, it works. It didn't. But my fun putters are the ones that get a lot of attention. Let's put it that way.
When Ryan talked about these fun putters, at least the one that you recently got, he's like, dude, you got to ask Keith about this putter. And he made it sound like initially that it was a cashmere putter, but it was more so it was a cashmere putter head. And then Charlie started, we started talking. It's like, what would it feel like if you hit cashmere ball insert with a cashmere face? Like it was a cashmere insert. And we're like, we probably would think it would be perfect on fast greens, right?
Well, let's put it, we got to find out. We're putting it out for the manufacturers to see if that is some R&D that they need to go down, and we'll find out.
It's coming off with no spin, but it's coming off soft as a butter.
We're talking about like launch monitors. I'd love to see the MOI on a cashmere insert. You know, just what are we looking at here? I just in my mind, Keith, as you're painting this vivid imagery, it just feels like this Napa putter is like leaned up next to a fireplace. You've got like a nice bottle of red open, you know, with maybe the ivory shirt on. You've got some kind of custom boutique putting mat here, entertaining guests and just rolling some putts with the Napa. Is that kind of is am I close there?
I'm gonna let you just keep imagining what you think I do, and I'm gonna just let it be. Like, I don't think keep going, anyone Charlie. Can build something different.
You're getting me there. I'm seeing it.
We'll put all this into AI. We'll put all this into AI and let it kind of just spit out some sort of imagery for us here.
Wait, what's on the DJ? I'm just really trying to set the mood here. What do you have? Is it soft jazz going on in there in the background? Just want to make sure I got the vibe right.
This is kind of another one of your things, right, Keith? You're a big playlist guy. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I'm looking at my record player and my vinyls right here. I just got that all set up. I'm a big music guy. So
it's record player on one side. It's like the custom mahogany putter stand where all four of them are all in order. And then it's like it's maybe it's a custom Sid Mashburn cashmere putting mat. Maybe that's what we got going there.
Charlie, if you want to float the bill for all this stuff, like be my guest.
Investors,
I'll implement all of this stuff, but you just got to pay for it.
So Keith, transitioning out of this amazing putter. By the way, you were an early Spider adapter too. We didn't even talk about that.
2019. That putter only was in the bag for one tournament, and it was Honda. I put it in.
It's kind of a hot putter now.
I put it in that Monday. One show up at Bay Hill, and it was loose.
Oh,
and so they had to like re-glue it, and it never went in back the same. So I used another putter after that. So that putter was one for the only tournament I've ever won on PGA Tour. That putter was used only that one tournament.
4 days.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah, that's insane. And now, all right. So I've seen you kind of change to different putters. You had a very toe hanging putter that you putted with last year. It looks like you have more of a mallet, less toe hang looks like now, but you're also going left hand low. Is that, when have you made that change, I guess, with your puttering?
So I was putting left hand low as like a young kid. Like that's what I started to do. And then I don't know when I came to the realization that Tiger didn't putt left hand low and Tiger putted like this, you know, with his finger down the shaft. I was like, well, I got to do that. I mean, that's what Tiger does.
That's how I did the same thing.
And so of course I started putting like that now forever. I went to left hand low a little bit in college. And then basically was traditional. I wouldn't even say basically, I would say I was traditional.
Most of your tour, right?
My entire professional.
I don't ever remember you being left-hand low until it popped on the screen like earlier this year. Yeah. I was like, whoa, when did that happen? Yeah.
Yeah, so I was left-hand low, like when I learned to putt, left-hand low in college, and then I think left-hand low now. And it all started at Pebble when, like, those greens, man, they hard to putt. Like, there's so much slope, they're so soft, and it's windy. You know, it's in anyway. I was just my head was doing that, and so I grabbed this Odyssey 2 ball that was super heavy because it was windy out there. And I was like, I need some stability on this thing because, you know, I'm using my little toe hang light putter trying to
That's
hit
right.
like this and all this wind, and it was not working. So I grabbed it and went with it. I was like, well, I'm going to keep this thing rolling, and been doing it ever since.
It looks good. Does it feel
Thank you.
good?
It
Does it feel
feels much
good?
better. I tell you what's even crazier is grabbing a putter traditional now. Feels way weirder than grabbing one like when I grabbed it
That's
left-hand low,
good.
it felt good, you know, but you know, I still put it this way. Now grabbing a putter like this, it's like, whoa.
We Smiley, as we kind of come to the end of this interview here, we've done Keith's attire, right? We've done the cashmere section of the interview. We've done putter tinkering. We'd be remiss to not ask some sort of a culinary question here. So I'm just going to put out like a very hypothetical scenario here for you, Keith. Let's just say Smiley was invited to play in the Zurich Classic. He ends up going on to win the thing. We're so thrilled with this comeback and his win that Zurich says, we're going to host a champions dinner for you in your honor. Smiley calls you panicking. He's saying, look, they want me to put together like a 4 or 5 course meal. I don't know. I'm out of my depth here. Keith, can you help me put together this menu? What are we building for Smiley's Zurich Classic champions dinner? What's that menu look like?
Smile. Well, I mean, that's your choice, Smiley. Like,
Well,
you
you're
gotta,
advising. You're heavily, in fact,
you are
you've been
being
delegated
called
the
as an
task.
advisor role to, I say, hands off the wheel here, Keith. This is all you.
And it's based off New Orleans cuisine.
No, it's based off of your cuisine, of what you want everybody to eat that evening.
So
I
we're
think I'm
basically my champion. This has gone from Smiley's champions dinner to my champions dinner. Is this
Yeah,
how it's transitioned?
that's
it's
where we
called a
are.
production device, Keith. All right, we're going to pull the curtain back here. Whatever we can do to get you to lay out a champions dinner using Smiley as like a shield, that's how we're going to get there. So
Okay. Well, I'll say this. Galatoire's and Clancy's are probably my two favorite restaurants in the world, and they're both next week or this week. Sorry, it's Monday, they're both this week. And I would say a lot of menu items that I would choose were based off that period.
Wow.
It's true. It's my favorite week of the year.
Favorite
But
thing on the, yeah, what's your favorite thing on these menus?
so at Galatoire's, it's a pretty simple order. It's like five appetizers, one entree, and you're gone. So that sounds not simple, but like potato souffle, fried eggplants, the gacio salad, the so that I think that's all the remoulades that it makes, like the crab remoulade or the shrimp remoulade, crab Maison, and crawfish Maison. And then the oysters Rockefeller.
Sure,
So
sure.
that's you just get you roll with that, and you get a bunch of bread. Obviously, they bring out these massive loaves of bread, and then you get the pompano with crab and a side of the spinach Rockefeller. So the spinach Rockefeller, the spinach that they put on the oysters Rockefeller, you just get just that as the side, and that's my Galatoire's deal. And then when I go to Clancy's, it's fried soft shell crab as an appetizer, the shrimp. Shrimp remoulade appetizer, deviled eggs appetizer, and then the veal annunciation is usually what I go with. And I mean, oysters brie too, if you really want to throw in, but usually I eat with a bunch of people, so it's not like I'm eating five entire appetizers like you
Dude,
go
the
with like
5 pound week,
6 people.
man.
But I will say the caloric intake in New Orleans is definitely higher than most. Wow.
Goodness gracious. Well, we know you're the co-chairman now with Maverick McNealy on that policy board, and we're not trying to press you on any of the crazy issues I'm sure you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis with the policy board. But I also think that while we're on the topic of food, there's a huge potential about going to different venues in bigger cities. Brian Rolapp talked about it in his big presser at the Players' Championship this year. And so, for you being on this seat, you know, are you trying to push everybody in the direction of where your favorite restaurants are around the country? Are we thinking about, hey, let's make sure we go to the east side of Chicago because one of my favorite restaurants is there. Is there any bit of that going on for you?
I wasn't smart enough to think about that angle, Smiley. I appreciate you bringing that up. That'll definitely be on topic. I mean, San Francisco does have some good food out there. And
some great
tracks out there too. So maybe we'll have to think about that.
We're gonna, but Charlie's gonna end up in like Kansas City because his favorite barbecue restaurant there or something like that. Yeah, I played here on the web, and next thing you know, we're playing next door to this like unbelievable barbecue spot.
They need to do the new schedule reveal with like Keith's restaurant list. It's like, we're going to this, like, we're not going to this venue. We're going to this restaurant on Tuesday night with Keith Mitchell.
Tuesday night's where you'll find me there too, because you know, that way you can feel like you can eat what you want and it's not affecting your performance yet. So Tuesday night's the deal. But I mean, you know, it's been a very, very busy, you know, first couple months in this job.
Yeah.
And it's a job. Like, let's be real. Like,
is it a second job? Does it feel that way?
It doesn't feel that way because I really like it, enjoy it, and there's a bunch of good guys on the board, and I love like the stuff we're talking about. So it doesn't feel like a job. It feels like I'm learning, and you know, we're making some good progress on stuff that I really care about. So no, the time wise though, it's big, and it's just more than usual because we have the policy board as is. Then you have the FCC committee, which is basically trying to lay out the entire new stuff. And then, so it's just like, it's kind of two things in one, which is a little bit more unusual than a typical player being, in this seat. But I mean, what a time to be on it.
Oh, absolutely. And I've often brought you up on the podcast when we've heavily debated just the fields and whether it's right with the signature events, how many players should be playing. And I've brought you up specifically because over the last couple years, I'll go and look at your stats. I'll go and look at how your results are and look at your points versus signature events. And I know you've played in a bunch over the years, but also you've been on just on the outside looking in. It feels like for a lot of them too, for you, has it been a struggle being just kind of that odd man in and out? It feels like almost every week for one of these things.
You know, it's usually because you've played well to get close to those. So, I mean, the struggle is not in that. The struggle is in setting your schedule. Yeah. And, you know, I'll show up January 5th or whatever in Sony, and then I will not know what tournaments I'm in or what my schedule looks like until the end of August. And like, for example, this year, you know, I played, you know, the first however many, ended up getting a sponsor exemption into Pebble, which is, I love that place. Thank you. But like, then that became my fifth week in a row. And I might have not scheduled five in a row knowing if I would have gotten in. I go home, don't get in LA. I play Cognizant and then I finish sixth. And I don't know until the last putt drops because Shane, you know, made whatever, unfortunately for him, made a couple doubles, changed the whole situation. I get in Bay Hill that week. That Sunday night. So then instead of driving home, I drive to Orlando to get in Bay Hill, which is great. Obviously good problems. Play the players the next week. And then I've played, you know, eight out of nine tournaments in a row to start the season. And then the next stretch is, you know, Valspar, Houston, San Antonio. And so I'm like, well, I was planning on playing those, but now that would be, you know, 11 out of 12 to start the season. So I got to decide to take one off. So I take Valspar off and then I go to Houston, San Antonio. Now I'm first alternate for RBC.
Which was odd, right? Because of the Brooks situation.
Because of the Brooks situation. So I know I'm not in the Masters. So I have a week off. I was planning on going to vacation that weekend because I was thinking I was going to have 2 weeks off. Well, Max birdies 18 and has a great Sunday. And then Brooks plays well. They both pass me. And, you know, Cam Young committed on like Friday afternoon. So I went from being in the field to being like three out and on Sunday, right? Like, so, you know, I'm like, do I have this next week off? Do I not? So anyway, Monday comes around. Potentially
have 3 weeks off.
Monday comes around. Exactly. Monday comes around. Justin Rose pulls out. So now I go to second alternate, but Brooks, we feel like Brooks doesn't take a spot. So now I'm first alternate. So I went from in the field to third alternate to first alternate. And so now I drive up, wake up, drive up Tuesday morning, sit around for, you know, 3 days, don't get in the field, come home. And then now I'm going off to Zurich. And how I would have played last week in RBC determines if I would get in Miami and Truist in the PGA. So if I'd gotten in the field, that could have solidified itself. Now I don't know if I'm getting in. So I'm going to Zurich this week. I might not get in Miami or Truist. So I have another week off and then I go play Myrtle Beach, or I could be playing in a major. So it's like, I've literally had no idea.
Schedule, man. Just bizarre. I hope that on being on the policy board, that eventually the tour gets itself in a place where the schedule makes sense for all its members, and all the events are great in itself. I love all the storylines, whether it's an open field event or it's a signature event. I just hope for someone like you who has no idea what they're playing good enough, like to play well and win these signature events, but they're also getting wore ass out trying to chase down getting in these events as well. So it's a double edged sword.
It is, and that's our goal. It's our goal is just to make it simple so that like I don't have to go through a 10-minute explanation like I just did of how I get in the fields. Because like if I have to explain it to you two, imagine what it's like explaining to, you know, your casual golf fan. So that's the number one goal. And Maverick said it great. Like Maverick's a top 10 player or what, you know, top 20 player in the world. And he was like, in my 8 years previous on tour, this was the first year that I knew every tournament I was playing in for the entire season. And it just says a lot about, you know, our kind of ecosystem. And so trying to simplify that, not only for the fans, but for the players is a top priority.
Your well-being, man. It's just like your mental well-being of like, honey, I don't know when I'm going to be home. I remember Ricky last year, at the end of the year, he was like, dude, I think I've been at home for 2 weeks. Cause he was in that same position of like, being in and out of signature events, and like you play good enough to get in, it's like, well, great. But oh, by the way, like you got to keep playing to try to keep getting in these. And the next thing you know, you're in the majors, and then it's a great year. But at the end of the year, you're like, I don't want to touch a golf club for a very long time.
My off weeks have become a lot more off in this schedule.
Is that right? A little bit of this?
Yeah, that's weather dependent, but trust me, when the weather's good, I'm out there.
Well, Keith, you're so great to take the time to hang with us. We're hoping that both the dining and the golf are exceptional this week down in New Orleans. And I'll just get over the blueprints for your new lounge. And just as soon as I get those done, I'll shoot those over. We'll find a sponsor to cover the whole thing. I'm sure Cisco could come in presenting sponsorship there, find a few dollars to make that happen, right?
Well, they've been, look, the last person I'm going to ask for more is them. They've been a hell of a sponsor, fair. To say the least. Fair, you're on the hook for somebody new.
I'm on the hook. That's good. I got to do a little sales. We'll make it happen. Thanks so much for taking the time, Keith.
Thanks, Keith.
Absolutely, guys. Good talking.
We'll see you next week on the Golf Channel. This has been The Smiley Show.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our lovely fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people at YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the...